So I've called this Plunging into the Positive. Kshanti and Virya. So first of all, Kshanti, the third paramita. Kshanti means literally patience or forbearance. There are other things as well, but I've tried to simplify it. I should add that I've tried to find different material to what's in the book. Yeah, I've tried to find something else. So quite what you make of that remains to be seen. Patience, forbearance. It also includes the idea of gentleness or docility, even humility. But in the sense of a positive, unconscious self-abnegation of spirit or a positive unawareness of self. So there's no connotations of passivity or quietism about Kshanti. Kshanti connotes love, compassion, tolerance, acceptance and receptivity. Kshanti is the basis of our relatedness to others. And it's virtually synonymous with metta. It's virtually synonymous with metta, which I find very, very interesting. It's the antidote to anger. It's the complete absence of anger or the desire for retaliation or revenge. And there are said to be three aspects. And these vary slightly from list to list, but what I'm following is forbearance, tolerance, and spiritual receptivity. And I think I've put them in that order as well. Let me just check. Yes, I've put them in that order. Right, okay, so first of all, Kshanti as forbearance. So to bear. In the sense of bearing up under whatever happens to you. In the Collins Dictionary, forbearance means self-control, and it implies restraint. So I think in the sense of Kshanti, it implies restraint of the emotions, even, we could say, restraint of the self. Restraint of the emotions is not easy to achieve, and we may even think or believe that we should not restrain our emotions lest we get blocked. Blockage was a condition that used to assail people in the 70s in the movement. You'd often hear older members saying, ooh, X is a bit blocked, isn't it? It's quite an interesting business. Hopefully we don't use that so much anymore. I don't think people are as blocked. Maybe it's the presence of sort of, psychotherapy and all that has let people let it out a bit. But that's got its problems as well. There is a difference between expressing anger and communicating it. And we should remember that. So we probably all experience this. We react, we get defensive, we retaliate in some way. We may not retaliate at the time, but we may carry the insult or injury in our mind and let it fester and simmer for decades, literally decades. I don't know about you, but I don't think I've had this for a few years now, but even up until quite recently, sometimes I'd be sitting meditating and I'd find myself rerunning an argument in my mind that I'd had at primary school in the playground. You know, just, I could have said this, and maybe I should have punched him. It's all sort of going, and I suddenly realise what I'm doing, and I'm supposed to be doing the metta bhavana. It can be quite sobering. When this is happening, when we have this sort of reaction, if you like, we must try to understand what's happening. We should reflect on our difficult encounters past, even in the school playground years ago, or recent, it doesn't matter much. Especially when they're coupled with a lot of emotion, when we find ourselves reacting. And of course, the emotion that's most likely to arise is anger, as I've said. Big questions. We can ask ourselves, how do I deal with anger? I mean, write it down, you know, and ask yourself this repeatedly. You might want to talk about this in the groups. How do I deal with anger? How do I deal with anger in myself when I experience it? And how do I deal with it when I'm around it in other people? These are big questions, and there's a lot of work to do, I think, with these two. Every time you feel yourself having a reaction, though, I think you should rejoice, because a reaction is an indication of, that one of the props of your ego, your sense of self, has been kicked away. It's been kicked out, so you just go into reaction, yeah? Anything to sort of defend yourself. It's an indication, yeah, that something that's been holding yourself together has gone. And you get in a panic. You get really worked up about this. Reflect on what's actually happening. And it's interesting, isn't it, that getting angry, getting emotional, even in any way, really, even getting reactive, makes us feel very, very solid and very, very real, doesn't it? We start to think, yeah, I can remember, you know, I mean, I've not been prone to anger a lot, but when I have got angry, I've actually quite enjoyed it. It's like, I feel quite sort of integrated in a certain kind of way, probably negatively. But I find that, again, quite interesting that we get so sort of, we can almost enjoy being reactive, negative, and angry, even emotional. I mean, you know, you fall in love, you feel really real, don't you? It's like something's happening. There's something intense. Maybe we are blocked after all. It takes something really intense to get through so that we can actually recognise that we are having an experience for a change. So I would posit that any intense experience is selfish. Yeah, it's selfish, not in the sense of being selfish, but it's appertaining to the self. And we should have a pretty good idea by now what we should be doing with the self. It's interesting, in the Sutta Nipata, the Buddha describes the sense of self as a barb in the heart. It's a barb in the heart, and it's painful, and it's hard to see. Negative emotions, including sort of anger and falling in love, render us unreasonable. You know, they render us unreasonable. If somebody shouts at us, especially if it's for no apparent reason, and we get angry, it's fully understandable, and we often feel completely justified in our anger, but it's totally unreasonable. It is not reasonable to behave in that kind of way. After all, if they don't have a reason for shouting at you, why should you get angry? Yeah, and if they have a reason and you're at fault, well, you know, we could just admit it and apologise. But no, negative states tend to generate negative states. We feel we've been wronged, so we get angry and we attack. Yeah, but it's, I would say it's a form of madness. Again, like falling in love. In counselling theory, there's a little axiom, there's a little motto that goes, we're never upset for the reason we think we are. Yeah? We're never upset for the reason that we think we are. And this is because we rationalise our emotions, and particularly our negative emotions. So trying to sort of work at building shanti, forbearance, is it's creating a gap in which we can try and respond rather than fall prey to an instantaneous reaction. So this first sense of forbearance has three strands as well. Again, as I say, the lists do vary a bit, but we can have forbearance towards people, towards nature, and towards our own body. Most of what I've already said refers to our forbearance with and towards other people, or our lack of it, very often. So any provocation whatsoever, we might be attacked, we might be robbed, we might be defeated, we might be insulted openly or behind our back, all those sorts of things, we should respond with the positive. We should try to respond with love, kindness, and compassion. We should be humble in this response, modest, and we should treat all people, no matter what, with respect, whether they be friends or enemies. We should treat them with respect. We should be easy to admonish, quick to apologise, and quick to confess. So that's people. Yeah, that's a sort of summing up of what I said about, you know, the first bit. Yeah, nature, forbearance of nature. Stuff happens. Yeah, this is a nasty Sahar world, apparently, where bad things happen, whatever you've done and whether you like it or not. But what did the man say? All compounded things are suffering. We are liable to experience bad weather, disasters, and reality with a capital R. Yeah, that's par for a human existence. And yet, when these nasty things happen to us, even bad weather, let alone disasters and reality, we tend to feel stunned and surprised. We can even get outraged when something goes wrong. Why is this happening? Why is this happening to me? As if it's some sort of gigantic cosmic mistake that we've sort of fallen foul of. Suffering is inevitable. It cannot be escaped because we've got a human body, so we must become wise. Yeah, that's the only sort of antidote. And then we should have forbearance towards our own body. Unfortunately, I mean, in my experience, this doesn't kick in until you get to about 45 or 50. Before that, you think you're sort of unassailable, completely impregnable, you're going to last forever, and there's nothing that can go wrong with all this. But over that, you know, the teeth get loose, the eyes get worse, you get aches and pains, and the bits you've been throwing around for years thoughtlessly start to ache, and you get rheumatism and old age, sickness, death, the great unknown. It's coming, yeah, and we have to have forbearance for that. Okay, two, kshanti as tolerance. There's quite a lot that could be said about this, but I'm going to keep it quite sort of brief. Really, this is allowing others to have their own thoughts and ideas, beliefs, even their own prejudices, yeah. And at the same time, Buddhism is very definite and it's very clear. And I think this is a very difficult paradox to straddle. And I think it's the cause of much suffering in our local sanghas. And I know in study groups that I used to lead when I was a sort of, a beginner order member, I used to try and stamp out people's prejudices and not let them have their own thoughts, ideas and beliefs. But that doesn't work either, because then people go into reaction and you're caught up in the whole business of there's no patience there and it's not helpful. Hopefully it's not so bad here because our study leaders are experienced and long in the tooth, and maybe we've even got some glimmerings of wisdom. So our touchstone in interactions with other people in terms of tolerance should not be belief, but Shraddha. Yeah, I don't know, we've talked about this quite a bit in our group. Belief is where you just have to believe this, whatever you think and feel about it. Whereas Buddhist Shraddha is born of reason, emotion and experience. Yeah, it's your own reason, emotion and experience, along with perhaps the testimony of those that you consider to be wise. Yeah, as I say, there's a lot that could be said about this. We shouldn't be, in Buddhism, although, you know, these things do happen sometimes. I believe they've happened in the past. But there shouldn't be sort of, pogroms and purges in Buddhism. That shouldn't really happen. But we're dealing with ordinary human beings trying to do their best, so mistakes will be made. Okay, three, kshanti as receptivity. This means constantly holding ourselves open to the truth. Open to the truth, yeah? We should be prepared to give up we already know at a moment's notice. Or at least give up what we think we know, if we know anything. There's that famous piece in one of Banti's talks, isn't there, where he says, it's not that we don't know very much. Actually, we don't know anything about anything. And if only we could sort of get that into our heads and our bowels, we'd probably have an easier time with things. But we think we know. It's interesting, when you study chapter one of the survey, in the first part of that, Banti talks about the ideal student of Buddhism. And one of the things he says about the ideal student of Buddhism is that he's prepared to accept whatever the truth about Buddhism might turn out to be. And I find this an amazing thing to write at the beginning of a book that's supposed to be telling you what Buddhism is all about. But in fact, I think what he's saying is that, no, he's just pointing in a direction. You've got to get there, and it may not turn out to be quite what you thought it was. So you've got to be open to whatever the truth about Buddhism may turn out to be. So our current understanding of the Dharma, or anything that we think, any view that we hold strongly, should be held as work in progress and held loosely, not with a terrier grip of steel as if our life depended on it. Then we're back to propping ourselves up with all sorts of funny views, and when they get kicked out, we get in a state. After all, have we really overcome all our wrong views? Have we really done that? That we can sort of close off and say, oh no, I don't need to know anymore. I don't need to know anymore. So for the sake of practicing the Dharma, we should be prepared to undergo and ignore all difficulties. This is what the Tibetans say. Heat, cold, objectionable companions, whatever. And the Tibetan sources really go to town on this. I rather like this. It appealed to me when I first came along to the movement 30-something years ago, and it still appeals. And I wonder if we sort of put some of this sort of stuff on the back boiler, the back burner, as it were, because there is this thing, I don't know if you've heard about this, Vajragupta, the mail order member, he's near Birmingham. He sort of went round the movement and he looked at all the advertising that we put out about our retreats and our activities. And he said it's all bunches of flowers and, you know, lovely white lotuses and serene Buddhas, you know, kind of thing. It's all a bit, dare I say it, a little bit wet, yeah? And you ask yourself, well, is that going to appeal to a young man in his 20s, you know, who's up for a challenge, who thinks he's indestructible and is prepared to go for it on that basis? Why hold him back by, you know, with nice white lotuses and bunches of flowers and, you know, sticks of incense burning tranquilly, you know, in the sunlight and all that sort of stuff. I think there should be more challenge, and maybe that should be reflected in some of our advertising. It certainly was in the old days. You'd get on the front of the FWBO magazine, you'd get a sort of house, and it had been smashed by a fist holding a vajra. You know, and the house was falling with big vajra, you know, it's like, yes, you know, give me some of that, a bit of challenge, you know, something that's going to sort of, that's got an edge to it. I think this is, what's his name, Patril Rinpoche, even through flaming infernos or seas of razor sharp blades, search for the Dharma until you die. Yes. The Kadampas have a little axiom that I'm very fond of. Again, I don't know why. I mean, you know, even at my age, this sort of appeals. My immediate response to this is yes. Yeah? They say four goals. Base your mind on the Dharma. Base the Dharma on a humble life. Base your humble life on the thought of death. And base your death on an empty, barren hollow. Yes. Something about me says yes to that. Because that's where we're going. I mean, you know, in the ground or burnt or whatever, you know. So, you know, in a way, this starts to hark on Virya, doesn't it? It's like, you know, let's get on with it. Where are we? Again, Tibetan sources. Now, this is particularly controversial. I'm not going to go too far with this because I think you may have to discuss this in your groups. But I'll throw it out, you know, on the possibility that you might have a reaction, which will be good because you'll get in touch with your emotions and you'll realise there's something propping up your sense of self. Yeah, Patril Rinpoche says, and he finds other sources to sort of back this up, you can't really combine dharma and worldly activities. This is what he says. I mean, I think that's quite controversial, actually. It's very challenging. And he says, well, the Buddha couldn't do it, so what chance have we got? No, the Buddha had to actually, you know, go off and hit the road. He had to leave it all behind. So, you know, where does that leave us? And Patril Rinpoche says, and again, something about this, you know, I say yes to, you know, there's something about this that really gets me going. He says, to claim that you can practice dharma and worldly life at the same time is like saying that you can sew with a double-pointed needle, put fire and water in the same container, or ride two horses in opposite directions. Discuss. Yeah? In your groups. Discuss. Yeah? As I say, it's... I know it's not as simple as that, you know, and, you know, we've got responsibilities, especially we've got a family and all that. But, you know, I think it means that we've got to really think about how we practice the Dharma and what we do with our time and energy. And talking of sort of energy, as it were, Patril Rinpoche also says that we should be prepared to endure poverty for the sake of the Dharma. If we can endure poverty, then we should be able to deal with our own death. And again, that's something about it in me says, yes, yes, there's something real and challenging and inspiring about that for me, I'm afraid. I mean, that doesn't label me, you know, single me out as a complete weirdo. Just to show that it's not just the Tibetans who do this. And again, Banti notes this in his book and in the original lecture, I think. There's this simile of the saw, which is a sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya, Sutta 21. It's a very interesting sutta. In a way, it's quite complicated, so I won't go into it too much. I mean, I'll read you sort of how it finishes off in a minute. But it's interesting because, in a way, it relates to something I've already said at the beginning. There's this monk called Molya Paguna, and he spends a lot of time with the bhikkhunis teaching them. He teaches them en masse, you know, he teaches groups of them, to the extent that if anybody criticizes him for teaching the bhikkhunis too much and spending too much time with them, the bhikkhunis get all upset and they rail to his defense. Or if the bhikkhunis are attacked and told, well, you're spending too much time with this monk, you know, he gets angry and falls into their defence, which is very interesting. Isn't it? I mean, they're both in reaction on the basis of, well, it looks like in the sutta, some sort of attachment. There's something a bit fishy going on with Molya Paguna and all these bhikkhunis that he's teaching. But anyway, that's an earlier part of the story. And when the Buddha's winding this up, he says to the bhikkhus, he gets all the bhikkhus together and gives them a discourse. And he says, bhikkhus, there are these five courses of speech that others may use when they address you. Their speech may be timely or untimely, true or untrue, gentle or harsh, connected with good or with harm, spoken with a mind of loving kindness or with inner hate. When others address you, and he repeats this, yeah, their speech may be timely or untimely, true or untrue, gentle or harsh, connected with the good or with harm, with a mind of loving kindness or with inner hate. So he says this twice, which I think is quite interesting as well. You don't get these things for nothing in the Pali Canon. The Buddha goes on to say, herein, bhikkhus, you should train yourselves thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. We shall abide pervading that person with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And, starting with him, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world, with a mind abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That is how you should train bhikkhus. And then he goes on to, and I think this sort of equals the sort of things that Tibetans say, say. He says, "Bhikkhus, even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handed saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teaching. Herein, bhikkhus, you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. We shall abide pervading them with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And starting with them, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That is how you should train, bhikkhus." And he, you know, it finishes up in the usual way. You know, the bhikkhus are all absolutely delighted. So it's interesting. I mean, I find that equally challenging. You know, I mean, okay, you know, these bandits get hold of you and they start sawing you limb from limb with a saw. No thoughts of animosity whatsoever. Whatsoever. I mean, it's almost sort of unthinkable. And then there's a very nice little quote that I like from Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. This is a bit more refined in a way. I've always liked this little quote, but I've only recently realised that it's actually about Kshanti. "The everyday practice is simply to develop a complete acceptance and openness to all situations and emotions, and to all people. Experiencing everything totally without mental reservations and blockages, so that one never withdraws or centralizes into oneself." Again, this, you know, you don't look into yourself, you go out. Brilliant. I was going to try and squeeze in Anuttapatika Dharma Kshanti, but I don't understand it and I haven't got time for it. But you might like to ask your study leader what that is, yeah? Anuttapatika Dharma Kshanti. Yeah? All effectively one word. Right. I've not quite got so much to say about Virya, but we'll see how we go on. So that's Kshanti. Virya. Means strength or energy. Sometimes it's called diligence. And this is energy in pursuit of the good. But we need to sort of think about this, because energy is not necessarily virya, and it's not even necessarily positive. And Gampopa, another Tibetan, defines laziness as being constantly busy and active in subduing enemies and accumulating money. And then the note at the bottom of the page says, subduing enemies is politics, and accumulating money is business. So, you know, that you may look very busy with those, but they're not energy in pursuit of the good. Energy in pursuit of the good is an intentness on, a powerful inclination towards the skillful. It's a very positive mental event. It's not busying oneself doing good. Virya is a mental event that expresses itself in action. It's not the activity itself, says Banti, which again is interesting. So it's not the activity itself, it's the intent. Yeah, it's the mental events that sort of power that activity, if that's what they do. Yeah. So perhaps, I think, and again, this isn't quite in Banti's lecture, but perhaps I think Virya starts with the four right efforts from the Eightfold Path, as in you know, Banti's Vision and Transformation. I presume you're all you know, eminently familiar with these, yeah? The four right efforts are preventing, eradicating, developing, and maintaining. So preventing. The right effort of preventing is we prevent the arising of unskillful mental states that have not yet arisen. Yeah, so we stop them coming into being when they start. Yeah. Eradicating is getting rid of the negative or unskillful mental states that are already present. Yeah, we get rid of them. Developing means that we're always trying to develop skillful mental states that have not yet arisen in our mind. And then maintaining, trying to maintain within our minds those skillful mental states which already exist. And I think we need to do this from moment to moment. Unfortunately, it took me many years, I think, before I actually realised how significant this little teaching was, and I really started to try and put it into practice. The older I get, the more it seems vital to me that we can evaluate our mental state from moment to moment. Okay, you know, sometimes we get in negative mental states, but we should know that that's what's happening, and we should immediately start to try and do something about it. Because we can't think, reason, even perceive, I don't think, accurately, if we're in a negative mental state, and especially if we don't recognise that mental state as a negative one. We're in a completely deluded state and we're just going to go completely down the cosmic gurgler, as it were. Yeah, we haven't got a hope, really, if that's the condition of us. So we've really got to be, we've got to be like a sort of a vigilant sort of shepherd with a flock of sheep. We can't take our eyes off our mental states for a moment, because as soon as they start to go into the negative, we're going to get in trouble. It's going to mess up our perception, and what follows all that? Well, suffering, big time suffering, basically. We can also say that to begin to work with Virya Paramita is making a conscious decision to apply our energy to our Dharma practice. And I got this off the web, but I think it's brilliant. What this particular writer did was he said, okay, well, this word decide is a very important one. Yeah, we've got to decide. We've got to make a decision to practice the Dharma. And the word decide literally means to cut off. Yeah, it's from an old French word, I don't know how you pronounce that, cadere, to cut off. Yeah, to cut off. So in making a decision, we're cutting off certain possibilities of action in favour of other ones. And this can be a big problem for some of us. Yeah? Some of us don't like making a decision. So if we're not able to make a decision, we can't start. We've got all these options open, but we end up not doing anything. And it's interesting, the sort of the traditional analogy for this, or sort of story for this, is we end up like a proverbial donkey, starved to death between two piles of hay, because he couldn't decide which one to go to. So he just dies, yeah, legs up. Yeah, we don't want to be like that about spiritual practice. You know, just dying for want of actually making a decision. Even if we make a wrong decision, that's probably better than making no decision at all, because at least we're trying something. And if it is the wrong decision, we can change it. Yeah, we can do something about that. That'll do for that, I think. There are some other bits, but they're dubious. Okay, so Virya can be of different kinds, and there are different lists. There's a list of three and a list of five, and they do sort of overlap to some extent. I think I end up with, so there's five and there's three, and one of the three doesn't correspond with two of those, so you end up with six. Yeah, they're all quite short, but bear with me. So, first of all, diligence in action. And really, this is a continuation of what I've already said. It's not putting off what needs to be done in the spiritual life. We need to act immediately. And the traditional analogy for this is, you know, you're sitting down somewhere and suddenly this poisonous snake appears in your lap. You just throw it off. You don't even think about it. You just get rid of it quickly. Or you're a dancing girl and your hair's caught fire. You've got to act quickly, or it's going to be the end of your career. Yeah, don't put things off. Don't wait for another second to practice. And think this was, yeah, this was Patril Rinpoche again. Our activities are like children's games. They continue as long as we continue. They stop as soon as we stop them. It's as simple as that, yeah? We just have to stop our silly little games. Then there's armour-like diligence, which is the same as ever-ready diligence. This is the readiness to apply oneself, and it's the stuff about this uses the analogy of putting on the heavy armour. It's like you're getting ready for battle. Yeah, it's that serious. It's that serious an undertaking. You've got to put your armour on, and the armour of virya will stop you getting into too much trouble. However, it doesn't mean that you're in a sort of state of hardness and sealed offness. Yeah, you're not sealed off by your virya. It's interesting that, I find it very interesting that virya tends to arise together with faith, with shraddha. They often occur together, and they're both wholly positive mental states. They support each other. They feed into each other. They sort of they have a momentum almost of their own once they get going. Diligence is applied work. Sometimes one's enthusiasm can melt away, yeah, when one's doing something to do with the Dharma. But this virya, which is applied work, consists in carrying on even without enthusiasm. Banti says we don't need enthusiasm to keep up a steady practice, and nor can we say that we don't feel like it today. He says that's just a rationalisation for laziness. No, apply yourself to the work. Then there's diligence which does not lose heart. So this is stout-heartedness, courage and confidence. Not losing heart in moments of personal frailty, Banti says. That's quite interesting. I'm not quite sure what he means by that. Moments of personal frailty. I suppose it's not giving in to your own sense of self-pity or self-worth or anything like that. Yeah, but he does say that this requires quite a bit of shraddha and quite a bit of self-understanding. Otherwise, you won't be able to muster this diligence which does not lose heart. Then we've got diligence which does not turn back. Now this is I liken this to signing a blank check. Yeah, when you get into the movement, I mean, I think even when you get into the movement, never mind getting ordained and getting a kesa, you're signing a blank check. You can't say, I didn't sign up for this. Oh, this wasn't on the agenda when I got ordained, or when I became a mitra. You can't do that because the unexpected is bound to arise, yeah? And when unexpected obstacles arise, you might want to say, well, I didn't plan for this. Banti says this almost always happens. If what you've undertaken is skillful, you just carry on. You don't abandon your original intention just because the going has become difficult. Yeah, you don't do that. You don't turn back. It reminds me of that little Tibetan saying that Banti always used to trot out in the early days, that apparently the Tibetans say, spiritual life, better not to start. Started it, better finish it. Yeah, you can't pull out halfway. If you started, you've got to carry on until the end. Then there's diligence which is never satisfied. And this is never resting on one's laurels. Virya should just go on and on, as long as there is something higher to achieve. And Banti says, well, there always is. There always is something higher to achieve. And this requires, he says, a perception and understanding of the full extent of the development represented by the path. So it's like, I think you've actually got to have some vision in the full sense of the term to really be able to sort of embrace this particular diligence, which is never satisfied. You've got to have a certain understanding and perception of the path in its full extent, what it really represents. So that's asking quite a lot, I think. This is a very well-known lama from the old days in the Tibetan tradition, Jigme Lingpa. To practice with greater tenacity, the closer one gets to death, is the mark of a Dharma practitioner who has not been caught by the frost. Yeah. To practice with greater tenacity, the closer one gets to death, is the mark of a Dharma practitioner who has not been caught by the frost. And the frost, he says, is the frost which destroys the fruit of your practice. It's the obstacles which prevent us from attaining our goal. It's an interesting little... So we've really got to sort of... The older we get, we should be really building it up, because we don't know. We don't know when we're going to go. We don't know where the finishing line is. So, you know, better finish with a spurt rather than sort of trickle across the line and hope for the best. So never feel you've done enough. And apparently, this is very important for great meditators or great teachers, because others will tell you, oh, you are such a great teacher. You don't need to do all this meditation. You don't need to do all this study. And unfortunately, sometimes you hear that from people who are sort of you know, junior to you, and you can begin to think it's true. And somebody called Dakpo Rinpoche said, thinking that one does not need such things proves that one needs them more than ever. No more to be said, I don't think. Gosh, oh, it's not too bad, right? Last word from Patril Rinpoche. I mean, I suppose, you know, just to sort of, you know, paraphrase all this a bit, I mean, what Virya requires is a regular practice. You've got to have a regular practice on a daily basis. It's interesting, a friend of mine, alder member, Banti, went to his town, and, you know, this alder member had, the privilege of showing him around town a bit, taking him out for a cup of coffee. While they were sort of walking along together, my friend thought, oh, I'll ask Banti about my meditation practice. So he said, what's important for a good meditation practice, Banti? And Banti sort of looked at him and went, it's got to be regular. And he went, because it wasn't. And Banti just hit him straight between the eyes with the exactly right answer. It's got to be regular. So that was the end of the all the questions about meditation. There was nowhere else to go on that day. Anyway, this is Patril Rinpoche. Always moderate your eating. Arrive at a balanced amount of sleep. This is all in the books about Virya. Always moderate your eating. Arrive at a balanced amount of sleep. Make your efforts steady and constant. Make your mind like a good bowstring, neither too loose nor too tight. It will get you nowhere to practice sporadically, only when you have the time.